Evening, everybody. It sure is good to see you. Josh, thank you for what you do, just bringing us before the Lord. I really appreciate it. To those of you who brought me Reese's peanut butter eggs in the aftermath of my Easter sermon, I only have one word: win. Win. Boom. Loving it. Yeah. Most scholars assume that John Mark wrote the book of Mark for early Christians in Rome. But I think what we can safely assume is that it is written to the non-Jewish portion of the early church. By the time this book's written, there are exponentially more Gentile Christians than there are Jewish Christians. And the other thing is that Mark leaves out stuff that would be important to Jews. And he explains stuff that every Jew would already know. So we got a pretty good idea of who his audience is. We also know this book is written either toward the end or just after the reign of Nero. Nero took the throne in 54 AD, succeeding his bizarre great uncle Claudius. Though his reign boasted some early accomplishments, his increasingly tyrannical style and his penchant for opulence led to a coup in 68 AD in which Nero committed suicide. When Nero was accused of personally starting the great fire of Rome in AD 64, he branded Christians as the instigators, and he unleashed severe and sadistic persecution throughout the empire. Let me tell you really quickly why Christians were pretty easy targets. Being a Christian was technically illegal, so it took the movement below ground. And of all of the traditions that they practiced, the one that really got them in trouble was this body and blood of Christ thing. And so they kind of got talking about Christians being cannibals. And what are those folks doing? And so this gossip mill, this rumor mill, sort of forms around the Christian community. So in addition to the popular accounts of Christians being thrown before wild animals in the Colosseum in Rome, and the martyrs of Peter and Paul, there's actually lesser known accounts as Christians being used as torches in Nero's garden. The painting that you're seeing behind me is called The Torches of Nero. It's painted in 1877 by Polish artist Henryk Szymierodzki. It depicts Rome in the aftermath of the Great Fire. And what you really have here, if you look at this rather busy painting, what you really have here is the emperor. Boom, see him? There's the emperor. And then you have this wild collection of people all around him, of various states of society. Remember, the kind of decadence that is going to surround Nero would be Bourbon Street Club style decadence, 24/7, 365. But if you look, boom, bam, 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 bam. What do you have? Christians being wrapped up, dipped in pitch, and when the evening comes, they are torches for Nero's gardens. So to put it in the simplest of all terms, Rome is a hot mess. Nero's three-quarter nuts, and Christians are scapegoats. Is everybody with me there? That's kind of what we got. By any definition, however, Christianity is growing rapidly. One of the things that you'll see about Christianity is that it seems to grow in proportion to persecution. The fire kind of keeps the Christian movement pure and honest. When Christianity begins to accommodate with culture, it gets soft and it loses its focus. It starts wanting celebrity when it accommodates with culture, but when it runs countercultural, it's always seeking servanthood. Christianity as a servant movement is in its wheelhouse. Christianity as a celebrity movement just breeds entitlement, and then all kinds of crazy stuff happens. So on one hand, we look at this and we say, oh my gosh, the Christians are being so incredibly persecuted by Caesar. This is an old Caesar coin. They're being persecuted. How terrible. On the other hand, the movement itself is doing just fine, thank you. It's doing just fine, thank you. We have some idea what Nero looked like, partially because of statues. Those of you who have ever been to Greece and to Rome, you know that there's a lot of marble statues made, but the heads are normally replaceable. What happened is emperors turned over pretty quickly. And so what they would do is you'd just carve a new head and you'd set it right in the old body. And most of the old bodies were pretty buff. I mean, if you look at the old bodies of the emperors, I mean, these guys look incredible. If you actually see their pictures, they look not incredible. But all the bodies stayed the same. But the heads of the emperors changed. But if you Google Nero, look at the heads, you get a fairly good idea what he looked like. And again, the Caesar was on coins. The coins minted under Nero would bear his likeness. Mark wrote this gospel in addition to being a biography of Jesus to offer hope and strength and courage to a really, really persecuted church. He portrays a Jesus who suffered and conquered suffering, who died and conquered death. He portrays a Jesus who was both affected by the evil forces of this world and had power over them. He depicts a Jesus who faced storms and yet calmed them. Putting Peter's stories and recollections into writing offered the Gentile mid-first century church a biography of Christ. And yet, always remember, Mark isn't just writing a biography. This is written to encourage persecuted Christians. Now, we have spent 3 weeks covering the first chapter of Mark's gospel. We've discussed the baptism, the temptation, and the calling of the disciples. In the aftermath, Jesus begins his ministry in the fishing village of Capernaum, which would have boasted about 1,500 people in Jesus' day. His initial ministry was defined by teaching, casting out evil spirits in the synagogue, and healing people, including Simon Peter's mother-in-law. Soon the crowds are following Jesus, and they swell. And all of a sudden, Jesus takes his healing ministry to a new level. And this is what I'm talking about. All of a sudden, Jesus is healing people that no one else can heal. Paralyzed people. People blind from birth. People who we would call were mentally deranged, that they would call spirit afflicted or demon possessed. All of a sudden, Jesus is healing stuff no one else can heal. And so people are bringing their folks to Jesus. Jesus is a magnet for the hopeless. You got to keep that in mind. His ministry is a magnet for hopeless people. Juxtapose that with much of the American church today that doesn't want to have a thing to do with hopeless people. He is a magnet for them. They are bringing the people to Jesus. No one else can help. And then all of a sudden, Jesus has to leave Capernaum and the synagogue there because there's too many people around. He has to start playing outdoor venues. And so he begins to travel throughout villages of Galilee, where he establishes further legitimacy by curing a man with leprosy, the most dreaded disease of their day, and a paralyzed man. So suddenly, Jesus is in the business of giving people their lives back. And I want to suggest to you, Jesus is still in the business of giving people their lives back. Amen. And that is part of the hope that we have at Easter. Jesus then chooses the rest of his 12 disciples. He catches the critical eye of the religious establishment, and he begins to shift his preaching style from John the Baptist's sort of apocalyptic style, and he begins to teach in parables. So rather than looking at our text today purely in a man versus nature motif, a la Moby Dick, I want to suggest that this is not just a story about a miracle, but it's also a metaphor. Look at the story as a metaphor for a suffering church or for a person going through storms. So here's our theme, really simple, and then I will argue it. Theme for the night, Jesus calms storms. Say it with me. Jesus calms storms. A lot of times we read, but we really don't get it. And I wanted to show you a quick video clip that hopefully will allow you to kind of feel the intensity of a storm. Take a look.
One day, Jesus got into a boat with his disciples and said to them, "Let us go across to the other side of the lake." And as they were sailing, he fell asleep.
Where is your faith?
How many of you have ever been caught out in the water during a storm that blew up on you? We have motors. These guys are going to have to row it in, right? We've got boats that are not as prone to sinking. I mean, this is quite an episode. Last week, I told you that in 1986, two fishermen, their names were Moshe and Yuval Lathan, were on the northwest waters of the Sea of Galilee in a time of drought. What they saw protruding from the mud turned out to be the hull of a first century fishing boat. I want to tell you a little bit more about that boat, because it's specifically that kind of boat that would have carried Jesus in the story. Experts tell us this wooden boat, and right there is the literal bolt hole that they pulled out. Incidentally, to give you an idea of size, Susan, can you stand up? It's going to be about from me. Susan, if you'd move right to the middle of that. It's going to be about from me to Susan, and the boat's going to be just a little bit wider than the aisle. Is everybody with me there? So that kind of gives us a good idea. Thanks, Susan, as to how big the boat is. Now, here's what we know. Expert tells us it's a wooden boat. It was in the water for 100 years. The high wear parts were constantly being repaired and replaced. So it's sort of like if you have a really, really old truck, right? And so you're constantly having to repair and replace. The boat is about 27 feet long, about 7.5 feet wide, shallow draft, and it could be sailed using a single mast or rowed by four oarsmen. So it has to have a crew of five. Now, this is where I get to be a real nerd, and I'm so sorry. But judging from the first century male skeletons that they've dug up in Galilee, the average male at the time of Christ would have been about 5'5". All right? About 5'5", and weighed about 140 pounds. So that gives you a pretty good idea. So such a boat could transport about 15 people. Is everybody with me? About 15 people, like an old church van. They had a capacity of about 15 people, all right? Now that you got an idea about the boat, let's look at the action sequence. Verse 35, as evening came, Jesus said, "Let's cross to the other side of the lake." Bottom line, Jesus is tired. Jesus is a trending local celebrity. Everywhere he goes, crowds follow. And by celebrity, I don't mean he bought into the celebrity culture. People always want to make leaders into celebrities. And that's why leaders have to constantly be climbing down off of pedestals other people want to put them on, all right? Because it's dangerous to them. It's dangerous. But I often think of Jesus' Galilee ministry like a band. You know, you got a local band. And they're pretty good. And they're better than the other local bands. And then they do pretty good. And what? They kind of do regional stuff. Now they're a regional band. And then all of a sudden, from a regional band, now they might open for a national band. And so Jesus' ministry is kind of starting in a synagogue in Capernaum. And then it kind of goes to outdoor venues. It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, some people came to hear Jesus teach. Others brought loved ones desperate for a miracle. And frankly, they didn't have cable, so some people just came for the entertainment. It was really a spectacle. It's kind of the hottest show in the region. Now, the Sea of Galilee offers a lot of natural amphitheaters. And by choosing to stand in a boat in the shallows, remember the boat has a shallow draft, and you choose a spot where the wind's behind you. You kind of have this natural sound system, and it's going to allow hundreds of people to hear pretty easily. And I have done this on the Sea of Galilee on past trips. I have found a cove, made the wind right, and I literally could stand at the shoreline and talk, and somebody could hear me a long way away. Jesus had been teaching in that boat all day, and he's tired, he's shot. I get that. When we finished our final service on Sunday, I went to my sister Jill's house for a late Easter lunch. I got home at 2:30 to take a quick nap. I woke up at 5:30. Don told me he slept 4 hours at his house. I just get that. Verse 36, Jesus was in the boat and they left the crowds behind. Here's what I need you to hear. Jesus took care of himself. He took care of himself. I was talking to Art and Martha. Art and Martha are normally our greeters, but on occasion they take a sabbatical from greeting. They still come to church, but they take a break from greeting. You want to do something for a long time, you're going to have to take breaks. Can I hear an amen from somebody? You know, I'm preaching Sunday, and we're doing Horse Trough Sunday. And then after that, I'm still around a little bit, but basically for the next month is when I take my time off. And it's when I can get away and I can be renewed. We're going to go to the mountains in Utah and ride four-wheelers. And we're going to go down to the Smoky Mountains. And we're going to hike and chase bears. And this is just stuff that works for us. But it's this process of renewal. I run Christmas right into January, February, March. And we, bam, hit Easter. We get through Easter. And then we have Horse Trough. We got confirmation. And after that, I literally wipe the sweat off of my brow, and we're going to take some downtime. Jesus gave us an example for that. I don't think many of us know ourselves terribly well. And a lot of you just run and run and run and run on autopilot, and then you break down alongside the road. Don't do that. Don't do that. Figure out how to sometimes leave the crowds behind. Verse 37, soon a fierce storm and high waves filled the boat with water. The Sea of Galilee sets 700 feet below sea level. Climate's pretty mild. To the west, north, and east, the lake is surrounded by mountains that the littler ones are, everything's bigger than the Ozarks, and most of it's smaller than the tall Smokies, okay? So kind of in there somewhere, 3,000 to 4,000 feet. You go up, it gets cooler in those mountains. Now, of an evening in the summer, the warm air rises, it collides with the cooler mountain air, and the air starts to spin, and then turbulence formed, and then there's gaps through the mountains. So in a sense, the wind gusts sort of start blowing through the mountains, but they get compressed. So it's like sticking your thumb over a hose, and the water starts shooting out. And before long, have you guys ever been in a city on a windy day, and you get in between two buildings, and you catch a wind tunnel? That's exactly what happens. So the Sea of Galilee can get really, really bad, really, really quick. Now, two Greek words are used here by Mark to describe the intensity of the storm. The first one is seismos. Anybody want to guess the English word that comes from that? Seismology. It's earthquake. It's a study of earthquakes. So it is bad enough. It feels like an earthquake. It is cataclysmic. And then second is kaleptesi, and it simply means to tower over. So the waves towered over them. This is a really, really particularly bad storm, even for lake personnel like the fishermen. Verse 38, I love this. Jesus was sleeping in the back of the boat. And the disciples awakened him. He didn't wake up on his own. And they said, don't you care that we're about to drown? You say, how could Jesus have been asleep on the back of the boat? Many years ago, I traveled with No Greater Love Ministries to an evangelistic outreach to the Indianapolis 500. We stayed near the track on that Saturday night in the midst of the party that rages on Georgetown Street. They asked for a volunteer to sleep on the bus outside instead of in the church. They wanted a volunteer to sleep on the bus. I looked around and I saw men who could snore the paint off the wall. And I thought, any opportunity I have to be away from these people, I'm in. I'm in. So I said, I'll sleep on the bus. So I went out. I pulled the things down. There was actually a place to sleep in the back, a driver's place. I went to sleep. Early the next morning, several of our guys came into the bus to see if I was all right. We didn't have cell phones back then. I said, yeah, everything was great. There were no problems at all. And that was when they informed me that in the middle of the night, that the party crowd had not only pelted the bus with debris all night, at one point they were on both sides of the bus and they almost tumped it over. And I slept like a baby. I had no idea that any of this was happening. So here's what I need to tell you. Sleeping through a storm's possible, all right? It's just possible. Verse 39, Jesus rebuked the wind and said to the water, peace, or silence, be still. You got to remember, peace in a fallen world is not the absence of conflict. We will never have that. It's the presence of God. Peace is not figuring out how to solve the drama that surrounds your life. It's learning how to speak the presence of God into that drama. In this rebuke of the wind, Jesus is evoking the presence of God into both the external atmospheric conditions and the internal fear of the disciples. He's saying to the storm that's raging outside, peace, be still. But he's also saying to the storms that are raging inside his disciples, peace, be still. As we pray for storms to calm around us, we often find that the storms are calmed within us as well. You see, peace be still is to take authority over our circumstances. It's to be the arrow and not the target in our own lives. It's to be proactive rather than reactive in our own lives. And you see, my friends, at some point, Christian people are just going to have to get sick and tired of being sick and tired, and they're just going to have to speak into their own lives and let God do what only God can do. And then it says, the wind stopped, and there was a great calm. Mark's reminding his readers that the same Christ who can calm a storm on the Galilee can speak peace into their troubled hearts. Those who are being hunted down by the Romans, those who are going to be burned as torches, those who are going to be literally taken into the Colosseum and devoured by wild animals for sport. Mark is reminding those folks, peace, be still. God can speak peace into your troubled heart. Verse 40, he asked the disciples, why are you so afraid? Do you still not have faith in me? You know, I bet the disciples were amazed, but I bet they're pretty quickly humbled. You see, the human soul cannot hold both faith and fear. Faith and fear are mutually exclusive properties. They're mutually exclusive realms of existence. If your heart is full of faith, there is no room for fear. But if your heart is full of fear, there's going to be no room for faith. By definition, the more you have of one, the less you're going to have of the other. So I want to tell you that fear, worry, and anxiety are more than predictable human response to stressors. They are first and foremost a lack of faith in Jesus Christ. How would it change our life if we understood that worry is actually a sin? That ruminating on our problems is actually a sin. Not a foible, but a sin. What if we really understood that when we worry about things rather than give them to Christ, that we are somewhere other than where Christ created us to be? We're taking the storm that only He can calm, and somehow, what is it we think we're going to do? I mean, seriously, what is it we think we're going to do? Verse 41, and the disciples were filled with awe. And they said, who is this man that even the wind and waves obey him? The story of the storm on the lake provided a perfect metaphor for those to whom Mark writes his gospel. Nero is persecuting Christianity as in a violent storm. And yet Mark reminds the church that Jesus is with them in the storm. Jesus is not fearful of the storm. Jesus can calm the storm, and Jesus will even rebuke the storm. And not only that, Jesus is actually going to rebuke them for their unbelief once the storm subsides. I can't tell you how many times in my life I've just kind of been consumed by worry about this or that. And then I see God take care of it, and I feel silly that I worried about it so much. And as I get older, I've seen God come through so many times. I got to tell you, I'm doing better. I'm just doing better. And I think it's a really important thing. So let me give you four straight up Jesus, and then let me give you a metaphor. Straight up Jesus. Number one, you need to prioritize your spiritual health. The Interpreter Bible reads, the truth that Jesus could always draw a crowd is not any more noteworthy than that he could leave so often. You know, when I took my first church in Georgia, it seemed like an initial match made in heaven. They were looking for a Messiah, and I thought I was one. 3 years later, when I got out of seminary and I had my first sermon at my first post-seminary place, I entitled the sermon, "The Messiah Has Come, and He's Not Me." That is what I learned in 3 years in seminary. Let me tell you what I have learned over the years. And I say this with all love and with all grace. I love being your pastor. I love what I do here. I am so grateful to God. He's blessed me beyond anything I could ever hope or imagine. When I said yes to the call of God, I never thought in a million years I'd preach to more than 200 people on a Sunday. 4,000 something on Easter? You got to be kidding me. I would have never even thought about that. But you know what? I love being your pastor, but guess what would happen if I died right now? Bishop Beard would appoint another pastor to this church. And that pastor would sit at my desk, and he would stand behind my pulpit, and he would preach each week. And then everybody would understand. It was never my desk. It was never my pulpit. It's never my church. I've always understood all of that. It's God's. This is all God's stuff. But you know, because I know that it's not all about me, and because I know that when I retire, whenever it is, somebody else will come and take my place, I don't have to carry all of the stress. I don't have to carry all of the pressure. And I know if you guys heard right now that I died, I know everybody go, oh, that's just terrible. But it wouldn't be 20 minutes before you'd start thinking about who your next pastor is going to be. And that's just human nature. There's nothing wrong with that. That's just human nature. And I find that comforting. I do. I find that really comforting. And because I know this isn't all about me, I can take my vacations. I can take my day off every single Friday. And I can tend my soul. And that keeps me healthy. Jesus realized that he needed food and rest and time in prayer if he were to carry on his mission. And here's the deal. So do you. If you're serving God in some way, you need to take care of yourself. You need to tend your soul. You need to have times away. You need to take a sabbatical like Art and Martha. And you know what's really interesting? When they take a sabbatical, it's not like there's no one to hand you your bulletins. People step in for a time, and when they come back, they'll just toss them the keys. When I'm gone, I'm not going to be gone a whole month this year. In the past years, I've taken 4 weeks all. And it's kind of like when I leave, I just think like if the church is a car, I just flip the car keys to everybody, and I just leave. And then when I walk back in 4 weeks later, I just walk through the door, hold up my hand, just fire them right back at me. You know, we're all good. But tend your soul, guys. I will say this, the more stressful your ministry and the higher you are committed to your ministry, the more you need to take times to rest and renew. I love Isaiah. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint. Really, really important. Jesus gave us a beautiful example for tending our souls. Number two, anticipate storms. Jesus told a story in Matthew about two houses. You guys remember? One built on the sand, the other is built on the rock. The storm came, and the one built on the rock survived, and the one built on the sand did not. Now, the big theme of the story is to build your life on solid things, but there is a sub-theme to the story. And here is the sub-theme. Storms come regardless of where you build your house. You see, a lot of times we got this idea that if you build your house right, if you do the right things, then the storms will never hit. Wrong. That is horrible theology. It won't last more than 8 minutes in the real world. Okay? So the reality is, no matter if you live your life well or poorly, storms are going to hit. If you live for God or if you live a life of decadence, storms are going to hit. Now, I'm going to be real honest. You're going to get more storms if you live poorly, because some storms are self-inflicted. Can I just hear an amen from somebody? You cut the self-inflicted storms out of your life, the storms do decrease exponentially. They really, really do. But there's some storms that are still going to be there. Storms are going to hit. Too many immature Christians believe that faith is like a get-out-of-jail-free card in Monopoly. And they think if they go to church and pray and give and read their Bibles that nothing bad is going to happen to them. And then what happens is something happens, and then they think God let them down, and before long, they're just out. And I'm sitting there thinking, Captain, God doesn't know how to let you down, but bad theology will let you down 8 days a week. And that's why it's so important, and that's why I'm just so proud of you guys for coming on Wednesday nights, because as we get into the Bible, we find out what Jesus really says. Most people's theology is built on what they've been told. But when you get into the Bible, you see what he really says. And when you read a story like that, you say, huh. So he's saying if I build on the rock or on the sand, that when the storm comes, my house will stay if I build on the rock. Yeah. But he's also saying that no matter where I build, storms are going to come. Yeah. Yeah, Jesus used parables because they continue to teach us regardless of cultural context. Whether Rome is dominating Israel or not, that parable still speaks and it still teaches us. You know, we need to anticipate storms because they're going to hit, and yet the better decisions we make, the fewer storms we're going to endure. Number three, go to Jesus during the storm. The disciples were saying, Jesus, this storm has gotten beyond our control. We cannot control this boat anymore. We are going to drown. Would you please take over? How many times have you been there in your life? What we really want is for us to keep the helm and Jesus to give us helpful tips. Right? But we want to keep the helm. We want to keep control. Jesus, tell me where to turn. That's not what they did. They said, Jesus, you take the helm. You take this. We cannot get this done. So the next time you find yourself beside yourself in worry and anxiety, instead of picking up the phone and ruining somebody else's day, right? Instead of getting on the Facebook and telling everybody how weak sauce you are, why don't you just turn to Jesus? Why don't you just turn to Jesus? And why don't you say, Jesus, will you take control of this situation? And I can always hear Jesus when I do that. He always says, is this situation stressing you? Remember, I was the guy asleep on the boat. It wasn't even the point. I was awake yet. Is this situation stressing you? And I'm always thinking, yes, Lord, yes. And Jesus is always saying, I've got it. I've got you. I've got your situation. And frankly, even if it doesn't work out on this earth, I'm not limited to this earth. I play in the realm of eternity as well. Jesus has it all under control. So here's my bottom line. If you want something tweetable to remember, here's this. We need to stop getting upset about stuff that doesn't upset Jesus. So the next time that you got something going on in your life, just say to Jesus, Jesus, is this overwhelming you? And he's going to go, nope. I was dead. I was in a tomb. I was dead. You think your situation's going to overwhelm me? You got to be kidding me. I read a quote this week about prayer in the difficult times, and I love this. It said, instead of rushing to communicate our panic to him, we should allow him to communicate his calm to us. And I think that's why we need to pray a little longer than we do. Dear God, I'm stressed. Amen. Maybe we need to hang in there long enough to see if he has anything to say. We're going to communicate our panic. But stay in the process until he can communicate his calm. He's got it. And then number four, let Jesus have the last word. Mark reminds his readers that when the waves die down and the winds cease, that we're often going to feel really silly that we panicked in the first place. I have this thing, those of you that are around me, some, it's a bad deal for everybody, but I have this thing I call the stub toe theory. And it works like this. I tell my grandkids this, I tell my family this, it's the stub toe theory. If you stub your toe, you really need to not act like you're dying, because in 120 seconds, you're going to be just fine and you're going to feel like an idiot. All right? Right? Is everybody with me there? I mean, you are. What hurts worse than stubbing your toe? But it only hurts for about 120 seconds. And if you are bouncing around, screaming and yelling like you're being filleted alive, I mean, good night. You're going to get done. And what are you going to do? Like a Gilda Radner impression from old Saturday Night Live and just go, never mind. I mean, what are you going to do? And so there are times you just need to control your impulses. Keep it cool, right? I love the old commercial. Never let them see you sweat. Just stay cool. Why? Jesus has got this. I read something really interesting this week, and it was a leadership piece on managing crises. It said 90% of all crises that occur in our lives will rectify themselves in 24 hours without our help or intervention. 10% won't. And they're a different deal, right? But think about all of the panicking we do. And 90% of those things are going to shake out just fine if we do something or not. So keep that stub toe theory in your heart. Why don't you take a moment and think back on the storms that you faced in your life? Now, some of you have faced some pretty huge storms. Some of you have fought and faced storms somewhat self-inflicted. Some of you have faced storms that just hit you out of nowhere. You know, one of the beautiful things, and I love this about God. I love this about God. Do you know the prodigal son story? You know, when the prodigal son finally comes back to the father, do you know the one thing the father never says is, I told you so? You know, the one thing the father never does is try to differentiate between whether or not his son made good decisions or bad decisions. All he saw was his devastated son, and his heart leapt for him. In fact, the parable reads, and the father ran to his son. Isn't that cool that God ran? God runs to us. And God doesn't sit there and say, well, that's self-inflicted. That's what Pharisees do. Well, you deserve that. If you would have made better decisions, God's not like that. God's not like that. God just loves us. You know, if I got a grandkid and their hand's bleeding, you know what I'm going to do? They walk up to me and their hand's bleeding. I'm not going to interview them about why their hand's bleeding. I'm not going to interview them and say, didn't Papa tell you not to do that? You know, I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to wrap it up. I'm gonna tend to them. If there's some lesson to be learned, we're going to have to learn that later. But not right now. My heart goes out to them. So think back on the storms that you faced in your life and reflect about how God has brought you through. Because here's the deal. No matter how bad you've had it, you are still alive. Amen. And some of you have defied great odds. Right? Faith is built by remembering God's faithfulness to us. And the more we remember, the less likely we are to overreact. The Christian can weather the storm calmly because we personally know that God has everything in control. He's got it. And we can walk in that calm. In 1633, this is a long time ago. Anybody know who painted this? Rembrandt, right? Not Harry Rembrandt that you went to third grade with. This would be the Rembrandt. He's a Dutch painter. This particular piece is called The Storm on the Sea of Galilee, and it's literally taken right out of our text today. It's Rembrandt's only seascape. It's the only thing Rembrandt ever did, and it's huge. I mean, you ever see famous paintings, and then you go to a gallery, and they're like 5 by 10 or something like that. You know, they're always odd shape. This thing's huge. It's 5 feet tall and about 4 feet wide. So this is really, really a big, big painting. And like I said, it's called Storm on the Sea of Galilee. In fact, if you know anything about art, this is really one of the great art mysteries of our time, because on March 18th, 1990, it was stolen from a gallery in Boston, and no one knows where it is. It even occurred on the blacklist. Raymond Reddington is looking for this painting right now. I mean, it's really kind of one of the great mysteries that there is out there. But I've got to tell you, there's a piece of this painting that's really cool. Jesus is with his disciples. He's with his disciples. They're on the boat. So how many people should be on the boat? 13. 12 disciples and Jesus. But if you zoom in and you count, there's 14 people on the boat. Jesus is here. If you look at the pictures of the painting, right? Because we don't really have the painting right now. But Jesus' face is a bit illuminated. It's a dark painting. But his face is a bit illuminated. So Jesus is here. Clearly, they're waking him up, right? They're waking up. The storm is still raging. And you say, but who is that extra person? Who's the stowaway on the boat? And we find him looking right at us. It's Rembrandt himself. In fact, when the painting is categorized, it's often categorized as a self-portrait. Boom. There he is. You see, placing ourselves in the boat like Rembrandt serves as a constant reminder to each of us that Jesus has even the raging storm you face right now under his control. So is a tempest raging in your life this evening? Is a tempest raging in the lives of the people you know and love? Then let your heart hear the words of Jesus. Silent. Peace. Be still. And then just take a breath and exhale. And just put yourself on that boat. You can be the 15th person on that boat. And remember, when we turn it over to Christ, the storm is calming down already.